Right. Well, good afternoon, good morning. Thanks everyone for joining us today. And I want to give a big thank you to Becca Willett, who agreed to be interviewed. So Becca is professor of statistics, I can say it, and computer science at the University of Chicago. And I'm Lee Green, and I run IRI's research and strategic initiatives. So as part of IRI's work to bring you leading-edge content on digitalization and AI, we hold webinars like this every other month, and we also do monthly roundtable discussions in which we discuss practical applications and challenges around digitalization and AI. And I'll be sure to sign all of you up to receive those updates if you aren't already getting them. And if you don't want to get them, please let me know, because I don't want to send you emails that you don't want. We all get too many. So just a few housekeeping items to get through before we begin the conversation. So first, this session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We will be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. And please hold all questions until the end, at which point you can either raise your hand and come off mute and do a face-to-face conversation, or you can just type your question into the chat and I will read it out for you. All right, boring stuff out of the way. Becca, again, thanks for joining us on this cold day.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me, Lee.
So let's start, just if you could tell us about your background and your work at University of Chicago.
By training, I'm an electrical engineer. So my degrees all the way up through my PhD were in electrical engineering, where I focused on signal processing. And there's a lot of commonalities between signal processing and machine learning. So I worked as a professor at both Duke University and the University of Wisconsin, and I joined the University of Chicago in 2018. And when I came here, I joined the departments of statistics and of computer science. And within those roles, have been working a lot in the context of data science and machine learning at UChicago. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of strong similarities and kind of a common core and foundation behind machine learning and signal processing. And it's been a really exciting time to be, working in this general space.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's get into the meat of things. So how do you see AI impacting science and scientific discovery specifically right now?
I think it's just going to be transformative. Just to put a to share a little personal story, when I was in graduate school, oh, excuse me, when I was in graduate school, like I said, I was studying signal processing, and one setting that I was exploring was medical imaging. So how do you take data, raw data, from, say, a MRI scanner or from a CAT scanner, and use it to form an image that a radiologist can look at to do diagnostics or other things? So I was at the hospital across the street from where I had my lab, and I saw a sign in the elevator, and it said, "If you sign up for some fMRI study where we try to understand what parts of the brain are active in different contexts, then as a prize, we'll give you a CD of all your brain data." And I thought, "Oh, that would be so much fun. I would love to have a CD with all of my brain data." And so I signed up, and it was just super interesting, and I learned a lot. But then a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from the head of the lab who was running this experiment. And he said, "When we started analyzing the data, we got to you and we saw that you had a big brain tumor." And they said, "We're just doing research grade imaging here, so we can't do anything diagnostic. You got to go see a neurosurgeon." And I did, and they did a clinical scan, and they ended up, doing some surgery and removing the tumor, and everything was totally fine. There were no lasting effects. But the reason I told this story is because I think that AI is going to impact just every aspect of the story that I told you. It's affecting the way neuroscientists design these experiments and try to understand how different activities are affecting what parts of the brain are active. It's going to affect the way that we collect imaging data, the way that we process it to form an image a radiologist can look at, the way that computers and radiologists work together to interpret that image, the way we make decisions about what interventions are the right choice and what the cost-benefit analyses are, the way that surgery is actually conducted and how robots might be assistive, even how we or what kind of drugs we prescribe post-operation, right? All of these things are areas where AI is playing an increasingly big and important role. And that's just in the medical context, right? People are also looking at AI in the context of building sustainable materials or thinking about how to build quantum computers, how to make climate forecasts, or even in the context of biology, how do we understand the rules of life? And so within all of these things, AI is playing an increasingly large role.
Okay, so let's go down to the basics. So what kind of foundational tasks do you think AI will help with?
Great, great question. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about AI in science, because we were talking about that just now. And I think, you know, naively, we might think that the way we use AI is going to be different in physics versus chemistry versus biology versus astronomy. And, you know, to some extent, that's true. It's 100% true that we need subject domain experts deeply involved in this process. But at the same time, there are common foundational issues that show up in scientific setting after scientific setting, where foundational work in AI is going to have a big impact across domains. So one example, for instance, is in the context of using AI to discover new laws of nature. So what I'd like to be able to do is to take observations of some system, like the way particles interact or something, and from that, infer what the underlying equations are that govern the behavior that I've observed. So not only do I want to be able to, you know, measure how the particles have been moving up till now and predict how they're going to move in the next 5 seconds, but I'd like to understand what those governing equations are, because then it gives me a mechanism for generating new hypotheses that I can test as a scientist, so that I can really try to understand on a fundamental level what's happening and not only, you know, make short-term predictions. And so that's one area that we see arising in many different settings. One of my colleagues here at UChicago, in fact, is doing this in the context of biophysics of cells and trying to understand how they develop and move. Another kind of cross-cutting setting is in generative AI. So I know that many of the people here in listening to us now are familiar with generative AI in the context of things like DALL-E for generating images or ChatGPT for generating text. And these are a lot of fun to play with and extremely powerful. On the other hand, we'd like to be able to use them in the context of science, right? So can I generate new proteins or new materials? Or can I generate new climate scenarios and explore what might happen in the future? But the fact is that in general in science, we've got way less data than we have that we've been using to train things like ChatGPT. And, you know, even if the total quantity or volume of data is on par, the nature of the data is very different, right? We've got a small number of samples of really high dimensional phenomena as opposed to, you know, every bit of text ever recorded. And so we have to really think about how to better develop generative models that can be used in the context of the sciences that are not going to be sensitive to this relative dearth of data. And so we have to think about, well, how do we incorporate physical laws, physical symmetries, whatever physical knowledge we have, to make sure that our generative models are consistent with those physics? In addition, we have to think about, you know, the possibility that in the sciences, the things that we want to generate might contain rare events or chaotic properties. So rare events, things that are really unusual, they won't really matter when we're training something like ChatGPT. But in the sciences, sometimes those are the things that we care about the most, right? The unusual things give us really important scientific insights and lead to new discoveries. And so if we're training generative models that totally ignore those rare events, we really maybe limit ourselves and limit the potential impact of AI. In addition, we can think about using these generative models to accelerate different kinds of simulations. So we use simulations to probe all different kinds of phenomena, say in the climate setting or in large-scale physics experiments or in astronomy. And many times those simulations have to be run on huge supercomputers. But if we can train a neural network to essentially generate samples that could have been produced by these simulations, but with a small fraction of the computational cost, then we give scientists a mechanism to explore these phenomena in a way that currently is just computationally prohibitive. You know, there's some other kind of foundational issues that I think are really at the forefront. One of them is uncertainty quantification. So right now, most of the machine learning models that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, you know, will take in some input and output a prediction. Like, you know, is it going to snow today? But in many cases, I not only want that raw prediction, but I want to know how certain the model is about whether that prediction is correct. I'd like it to tell me, oh, there's a 40% chance of it snowing today. And hopefully, of all the times it tells me there's a 40% chance of snow, 40% of those times it will actually snow, right? Hopefully it's well calibrated so that those percentages are actually meaningful. And so this is something that we're familiar with in the context of weather forecast, but something that's been somewhat remote from a lot of the AI and machine learning practice in the past. And so one of the key tasks that is being explored by scholars is figuring out a better way to make well calibrated, quantifiable uncertainty assessments associated with predictions coming out of AI models. And this is really helpful, right? I mean, if I'm trying to understand something about the sciences, I don't want to just take some raw prediction at face value. But in addition, if I'm working in the sciences, maybe I want to decide, you know, which new experiment might be most worth my time. And so what I want to do is I want to identify where my model is really certain that it can make good predictions and where it's got a lot of uncertainty. Because in the regions where there's a lot of uncertainty, maybe that's the best place for me to dedicate my future experimental resources. So that's just a smattering. I don't want to monologue too long here, but it's just a smattering of some of the different tasks that people are studying on a foundational level that I think are especially relevant to science, scientific discovery, engineering, and even manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could definitely see where the trust issue is huge. We've always been talking about that, just even, you know, back when they were doing basic, you know, simulations of things. And, you know, scientists aren't necessarily the most trusting people when it comes to this sort of thing. So
yeah,
no, it's going to take a while.
You know, like just the other day, I was playing around with ChatGPT and I said, tell me three reasons that badminton is safer than football. And it gave me some caveats. Like it said, you know, many people don't really see badminton is safer than football. It was not total garbage. But then it said, you know, here are some reasons that people might point to. And it said things like football players wear more protective gear, or football players are better or more physically fit in general. And, you know, these are things that I think on the surface are plausible, right? And I think we have common sense that tells us that these are not reasons that it's safer, but they could, to the uninformed, seem plausible. And so if I wanted to use that kind of tool to say, hey, why did manufacturing process A give me a higher yield than manufacturing process B? and expect a tool like this to give me something meaningful, I need to be very cautious, right? It's going to tell me something plausible, but I should very much treat that as a hypothesis that I have to test. And we also just need to do additional foundational work so that we can more accurately like extract useful information for scientists as opposed to just making something up that may or may not be relevant to the task at hand. I think this goes hand in hand with some of the trust issues that you identified.
Yeah, I think we've got a little ways to go there. So let's talk about failure modes and how AI can help with those, and you know, just identifying what to watch out for, kind of carrying on the same thought process here.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what we just talked about with this badminton example is one possible thing, right? Some of these tools are designed to produce outputs that are plausible, that are believable to a human observer. And that's not necessarily our goal when we're thinking about science and engineering. And so I think to some extent, we need to, you know, gear our minds towards understanding what these tools can and cannot do well. I think another sort of failure mode to be careful about is ensuring that you've got enough data and that it's sufficiently diverse. So imagine, for instance, that I wanted to train a computer vision algorithm to take in an image and tell me whether it contains a cat or a dog. And I feed it a bunch of training images, and all of the cats in my training data set are indoors, and all of the dogs are outdoors and in the grass. So a method that's just trying to learn the difference between cats and dogs based on data in a totally data-driven way where I don't impose any other constraints could very easily say, well, whenever I see grass, it must be a dog and not a cat. And we can immediately recognize this as a fallacy, as a spurious correlation in our training data set. But, you know, in many other more complex data sets where we don't really know what the hallmark features are, we run the risk of having similar kinds of spurious correlations that are not nearly as easy to identify. Right. You could imagine, for instance, somebody trying to train a machine learning tool to take an X-ray image of lungs and identify whether or not somebody has pneumonia. And on the surface, that sounds like a pretty good task for a machine learning tool. But you have to think about, well, where did that data come from? Maybe the hospital that collected the data had this practice where if we suspected a patient had pneumonia, we had go collect the X-ray image using scanner A. And for other patients that were interested in other things, we use scanner B. Then we run the risk of when we train the machine learning algorithm to determine whether or not somebody has pneumonia, it hones in on subtle differences related to whether we use scanner A or scanner B, right? Something that's a spurious correlation that really doesn't reflect the pathology that we're interested in. And so this is where, you know, worrying about the diversity of the data is really critical and can lead to, you know, misleading results if we aren't careful. You know, another example is not just about the quantity and diversity of data, but also, you know, how we choose to train these systems. So there was an article, several articles recently, that were highlighting how a major algorithm that was designed to predict the healthcare needs of different patients had a significant racial bias. And this was somewhat surprising because people were aware that you needed diverse data, and they had a data set that really reflected a broad array of different people from different backgrounds, different, you know, ethnic groups, different races, et cetera. And so the data itself, or the group of people being represented, was quite diverse. And yet the final algorithm had this racial bias. So what happened here? Well, what happened was that they were trying to predict whether or the amount of healthcare services people would need. But they didn't have a good way to put a number on that. And so they used a proxy, And they said, instead, what we're going to do is we're going to try to predict how much money people are going to spend on healthcare. And it turned out that this was a very poor proxy because different socioeconomic groups, different ethnic and racial groups, access the U.S. healthcare system in different ways. And so what the machine learning system was doing was it was identifying these differences and homing in on them in a way that was, you know, quite biased, right? It was predicted because people's expenditures were different and not really aligned with their healthcare needs. It was doing a poor job at predicting needs and really only predicting expenditures. So these are some kind of major pitfalls that we have to be extremely careful about. And in general, you know, these tools are becoming more and more accessible, right? Any of us can go online and download major machine learning models and try to use them in various contexts. And mainly this is super exciting, right? It really democratizes the use of these tools and allows them to be highly impactful. But at the same time, it also presents opportunities for people to use these tools without really understanding, you know, how they were developed, what assumptions went into that development, what their intended purpose was, how that intended purpose relates to, you know, what I'm actually using it for, et cetera. And, you know, there have been articles, for instance, in Wired magazine that have said that there's an increasing problem with replicability in the scientific literature due to people misusing AI tools or machine learning tools. Not maliciously or out of negligence, but rather just not fully understanding the context in which it might or might not be appropriate to use these tools due to lack of training. And because of that, maybe, you know, publishing a result that looks exciting, but ends up not being repeatable. So these are some pretty major failure modes. And I think, you know, thinking about machine learning and AI as more than software development, where just being good at taking this code and figuring out how to build, you know, new systems within your field is necessary, but absolutely not sufficient. They're really understanding what these tools are doing on a fundamental level and what pitfalls are associated with them is just going to be critical to ensuring that we can trust the results that we're getting using these tools.
Okay, yeah. We've all heard about the bias issues and things like that, but I think that, so even when people are trying, it could still crop up, and that I think that's what's scariest about it. When we think we're doing it right, we're still not doing it right.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, this is why, you know, having, you know, courses, webinars, other kinds of opportunities to learn about these tools is really essential. But just thinking, oh, I can go online and download the code and plug it in and see what happens might not be sufficient. And for all kinds of reasons, right? Like, I think one thing that's happened in the past is that we've got these data sets that we use for training image recognition systems. So they've got lots of different images in them, and each image is associated with a collection of labels saying what the content of the image is. But what we sometimes fail to recognize is that those data sets have been curated, and that curation is playing a role. And so there was an example. This is a few years old now, but at some point, someone took one of the state-of-the-art image recognition systems, and what they did is they said, all right, I'm going to take a nature BBC documentary of a polar bear walking around, and I'm going to plug each frame of this video into this image recognition system and have it tell me what's in each frame. And as you watch this go by, you know, sometimes it says polar bear very accurately, and then sometimes the polar bear moves just a little bit because it's walking around. And then the next frame, it's slightly shifted. And all of a sudden you get a totally different label, like mongoose or weasel or something, something reasonable, right? It's not like it's making a totally bizarre prediction, but at the same time, it's highlighting how just a small shift, not an adversarial shift, nobody's trying to deliberately fool this method, but just like a small natural shift in the image is inducing a major change in the prediction. And I think, you know, it wasn't recognized in some of the early experiments how susceptible we were to those shifts, in part because the data that we were using to test and train these methods had been so carefully curated. And so we didn't see data that reflected these tiny little shifts or these tiny little perturbations. And as a result, we didn't realize that this was a potential major vulnerability. And so not only do we need to have very good understanding of these methods, the underlying assumptions, and an understanding of whether the way that we want to use these methods is appropriate or not, but we also need really good data for testing and vetting and verifying these different methods in the context in which we're going to be using them. And thinking about how that test data has been set up and generated and curated is just a vital step in this process for the reasons that I just outlined.
Okay. So kind of going big picture, you know, where do you think we're going here, you know, particularly with scientific applications?
Yeah, great question. In terms of the applications, you know, I mentioned some sort of moonshots earlier, right? Really thinking about how this can be used to improve healthcare, for instance. And one aspect of this is drug development. So I think many people here may be familiar with AlphaFold, which has been used to try to understand the structure of different proteins and was really, you know, a groundbreaking development in AI, especially in the sciences. And more generally, there's interest in using these and similar tools to accelerate the pace of drug development, not only identifying targets, but thinking about how well we can synthesize different pharmaceuticals, what our yields might be, et cetera. And I'm really excited about this in part because, you know, since drug development is such a labor and resource intensive process, we tend to focus those resources on diseases that particularly, large groups of people have, especially large groups of people with insurance. And there's many communities that are, you know, underemphasized, or many diseases that are impacting sort of smaller communities or less wealthy communities that aren't getting the same amount of attention. And I think that if we can figure out how to use AI to make this whole process more affordable and faster, then we're going to open up the door to developing pharmaceuticals for a whole range of settings that so far have not received as many resources as we would hope. So this is one example. Another example is in engineering new materials, especially sustainable materials or green materials. You know, similar to what we see with drug development, this can be a pretty labor and time consuming process designing new materials. But there's a lot of interest in trying to use ideas from AI and machine learning to help design new experiments, to uncover kind of key principles that we can use to understand what makes a material better or worse and guide our thinking in the design of new materials, et cetera. So that's just a snapshot of some of the key sort of applications. But a little bit more broadly, you know, I think things like trying to accelerate really time-consuming, intensive computer simulations is a major area that's receiving a lot of attention, right? So instead of running a climate model on a supercomputer, I'd like to be able to run it on my desktop. And if I can do that, I can do things like explore a whole bunch of different, you know, scenarios. Like maybe, oh, if the temperature changes just a fraction of a degree, how does that change the likelihood or intensity of hurricanes. I would like to understand that because that's going to help me design better economic policies or other kinds of, you know, disaster relief policies. And the better I can make those predictions, and the more I can explore the whole range of possible outcomes that we might experience, the better policies we'll be able to develop as a result. And so I think this task of using AI to accelerate those simulations so that they can be used much more effectively is going to be hugely impactful and is a really exciting area of development.
Yeah, definitely. And super exciting for our group here, too, when we're thinking about developing new materials, and especially around sustainability. So before we go to the audience for questions, just one more. You're at a university. You're seeing the students. How are they using it? What's going on there? What do we need to be looking out for as the interns come in and the postdocs and all that? So yeah, what do we need to know?
Well, I think, you know, many students are using it to get a high-level summary of something that they're struggling to understand. You know, so maybe in my lecture, I give a really complicated and inaccessible description of logistic regression, and a student's really struggling with it. Then they can go to a tool like ChatGPT and say, you know, give me a simple explanation of logistic regression. And use that to then kind of, you know, understand that kind of high level perspective and then make my lecture materials more accessible or something. And I think that's a fantastic use, especially for well-studied topics like logistic regression, where there's been a lot of material published and therefore ChatGPT has had a lot of material to learn from and can generally produce pretty good insights and summaries. So I definitely see a lot of that, and I think it's great that they have that tool available, because I certainly have struggled myself to understand things at first, where I feel like I understand all the details and I just do not see the big picture. There are, of course, other examples that aren't so positive that we've read about in the news about students using it essentially to cheat, right? Like some of these tools are so powerful that they can help answer questions on homeworks or exams or help write essays. And that's obviously bad, and it's affecting the way that we design assessments in universities, trying to figure out ways to ensure that students really are learning and using tools when appropriate, but also, you know, making sure that they have a full understanding of the core concepts. And that's a work in progress. There's a lot of people who are thinking very critically and very carefully about the best way to assess student learning when we know that these tools are now available. And then I also see them using, you know, tools that can just help them improve their writing. I myself use Grammarly, for instance, all the time, and find it to be extremely useful, and just helps me identify places where maybe I haven't been so clear. And I see, you know, students using similar tools. And especially when I have students coming from, you know, backgrounds where English is not their first language, I think these are great tools that can really help, you know, help others see how talented and skilled they are, even when, you know, maybe they would have been written off due to language difficulties in past times, unfairly written off. But I think some of these tools and technologies are helping students sidestep those biases. It's very much, you know, there are very much some trade-offs here, some really positive uses of the tools for students, and also, you know, some opportunities for students to be led astray and to use these tools in unethical ways. It's something that of intense interest throughout the university.
I'm sure. Yeah, I was surprised. So I have middle schoolers and they all have, you know, the same laptop, and they turned it off. And I was like, well, I wasn't surprised. I mean, that's the easy option, but it just seems to me like it's a missed opportunity. Like they're young enough where they could be trained to use it properly. And you can tell if a middle schooler has pulled an essay off of ChatGPT, it's pretty obvious. Like, yeah. You know, any middle schooler that submits an essay from ChatGPT, they're taking their own risks. But it just seems like this is a good chance to start integrating it into how they do things. And it just seems like a missed opportunity for them. But I know it's hard and intimidating.
I know that there are, companies, different nonprofits, as well as universities that are absolutely thinking about how can we use this as an educational tool? Because you're right, it is a missed opportunity to just say we're not going to use it at all. I think I read something like Khan Academy was trying to leverage some of these tools. And, let's just think about it in general, right? When you're first learning a new concept and you're trying to solve some practice problems, maybe you think, I think I'm doing this right, but I'm not really sure. And if I have to turn in a whole assignment and then wait another week for it to be graded, there's a huge feedback delay. And if I'm just getting instantaneous feedback, then that's enormously helpful. And so developing ways for students to get real-time feedback so that we understand where the conceptual gaps are and where the students have the skills that they already need is going to, I think, present real nice opportunities for education. And I don't know exactly how that's going to manifest yet, but I think you're right. To ignore that would be a missed opportunity. And I'm really excited that education experts are thinking carefully about this.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Who has questions for Becca? We'll open it up to the audience. I'm sure people are going to be putting them into the chat and getting, and you can also raise your hand. All right, Benjamin, go for it. I saw you unmuted. You raised your action.
I did unmute. I raised my hand physically. Hi, how you doing, Ben Messmore? I've been asked how AI is going to transform our current businesses today from an R&D perspective, which I find to be a daunting question, because often, I'm running design of experiments and I'm trying to minimize the number of data points I need to go out and get because of the effort that it takes to get that data. And so, in a world where you don't have access to large data sets, how do you think AI can be used in those particular cases? In general, I had a couple of ideas, but curious to get your thoughts on the matter. And maybe it's more banal and, front end, as opposed to analysis on the back end.
Right. So one thing that the people are doing is using what they would call pre-trained models. So let's say, for instance, that I want to analyze a bunch of microscopy images, but I only have a couple of hundred. That's maybe not enough to train a really large scale computer vision model. But what I could do is I could take a computer vision model that's just been trained on millions and millions of images from all over the place. And then I can take that model with all of its parameters and weights learned using lots of images that are maybe a little remote from my application. And then I'm going to take my couple of hundred of microscopy images and use that to just fine tune that model I downloaded. So this is, some people would call this pre-training, some people call the pre-trained model a foundation model, but there's a lot of interest in that because of exactly the scenario you're describing, right? I would like to harness the power of these tools. And, it to some extent makes sense that this is possible, right? Because I have grown up looking at all different kinds of images, it takes relatively little training for me to understand as a human how to look at microscopy images and interpret them. And so it also makes sense that, these systems, when we're pre-training them, are learning something just about the general structure of images, smooth areas, edges, the kinds of features that our brains home in on. And from that, coming up with a model that we can easily adapt to new settings.
That's awesome. Thank you very much. That's great. I wasn't aware that some of those may exist, and I've Googled it and already find it. It's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. Great.
Thank you.
All right, they're rolling into the chat now. So we've got UQ and sensitivity analysis and other statistical methods have been used for decades in the aerospace industry. It seems now that they are getting some more attention due to ML. Do you see concrete new progress in this area?
Yeah, great question. So this has been well studied for a long time. You know, some classical methods might make really strong assumptions about the model, like what prediction model we're using. So for instance, if I'm going to make a linear predictor, then I can do UQ associated with that because I understand the model really well. But those techniques I can't apply generally to really large complex models like, say, a neural network. Another class of approaches that's associated with UQ are Bayesian models. And Bayesian models are good in a lot of settings, especially when we have good prior knowledge. Say the parameters we're trying to estimate have some sort of like physical interpretation, and I can design good priors. When the models are the parameters that I want to model and have a prior for are things like millions of parameters in a neural network, then it's a little bit more difficult to know whether I've got a good meaningful prior and whether I can really trust my posterior variances that I use to quantify uncertainty. So while there is this really rich literature, there are some limitations associated with it. And so more recent progress has been in a couple of veins. There has been quite a bit of work in the Bayesian setting, trying to think about how we can adapt Bayesian methodology to some of these large-scale machine learning models like neural networks. To complement that, there's also been a lot of progress and exciting work in the context of something called conformal inference. So the idea here is that you're going to use some sort of calibration data to basically produce prediction intervals. So instead of saying, having a machine learning model, say, I'm going to predict that you're going to get 2 inches of snow tonight, we're going to use this wrapper basically that will say, take that machine learning model and figure out how to say the amount of snow you get tonight is going to be between 1.7 and 2.4 inches with 90% probability. And so these techniques present, I think, new opportunities that rely on much weaker, if not zero, assumptions on the kind of machine learning model that we use. And I'm really excited about the potential of those approaches.
All right. Tyler, I hope that answers your question. Oh, wait, no, sorry, that wasn't Tyler, that was Alberto. Tyler is the next one. So Tyler is asking, do you know of any generative models which are being developed for use in formulation chemistry?
I'm sorry, I don't. I am not familiar with formulation chemistry. I do know in general, there's a lot of interest in generative models for molecular structures, but I don't know specifically about formulation chemistry. I'm sorry.
It's fair enough. All right. So Todd asks, how do you see Gen AI's future role in the practice of scientific exploration? For example, generating the best next questions to be asking and designing relevant experiments.
Right. So I think of generative AI in a very general sense. So I think your question is targeted at things like text generation. But we can also think about it, like I said, like thinking about new climate scenarios or generating new examples of materials or proteins. In the context of text generation, I think the example that you list is excellent, right? You want to give it some data and say, what are the next best questions to be asking? Or, you know, what next experiment should I run? I think that's a great aspiration. I think there are limitations there, though. And I think, you know, a really helpful experiment that any of us can run is to go to a tool like ChatGPT and ask it a series of mathematics questions, you know, multiplication, division, things that are maybe a little more complicated than that. And some of them it does quite well, surprisingly well. Like I'm very impressed with its capabilities. But you can relatively quickly get to a point where it cannot self, you know, simple mathematics problems. And if it can't do some basic mathematics, then you also have to wonder about its ability to do the kind of logical inference task of figuring out what experiments are going to be most relevant to resolving a particular hypothesis. And so I really don't think we're there yet. But I know this is something that people are deeply interested in. I think what's maybe a little bit more immediate or has more potential in the immediate short term is trying to use some of these generative text models to do a literature review, to say, tell me everything you can tell me about, I don't know, generative models in formulation chemistry, for instance, right? And that can sometimes provide, you know, a helpful overview of a field that maybe has many, many papers that would take a great deal of time to survey all of them. But it, you know, it's also been known or shown to make up fake references. And so you still have to take all of these things with a grain of salt. So I think there's a lot of potential, but I think it's going to take a lot of effort by the whole kind of community to get to that point.
All right. And I think we've got time for two more questions, and we've actually had two come in around synthetic data. So, you know, what are your thoughts about it being used for training purposes for larger models, and also, you know, how it's going to impact accuracy?
Yeah, I think that it's really kind of application specific. So there are contexts like using simulators for driving to generate data that we can use to train self-driving cars. And, you know, to some extent, I think, first of all, that's worked really well. Also, it allows us to generate data associated with crashes or high-risk situations that we don't want to generate outside of simulations. And so I'm excited about that. On the other hand, there are absolutely, you know, limitations associated with that. In general, the data coming out of simulators is an approximation of reality. And so you run the risk that you're training a model to only understand that approximation, and everything that's not represented by your simulation is going to not be represented by your learned model. I think what makes the most sense is to first do some sort of pre-training on your simulated data, and then go through this process of fine-tuning using limited real-world data, so that you can adapt to the differences of the distributions of the simulated data and the real world data. In general, thinking about the best way to co-leverage or co-exploit both observational data and simulation data, you know, there's a lot of approaches that are out there. I think there's not like one coherent, clear, best way to use it. It's still context dependent, but it's a great question.
Yeah, that's going to be hugely tricky. Wow. Okay. So last question, Mass asks, so could you share your perspective on how personal LLM models like local on user PCs might be used differently than more global solutions like ChatGPT or AlphaFold?
To the best of my knowledge, the local LLM models are, you know, fine-tuned versions of pre-trained models. So they still have a common base and a common core. I believe that those models are especially nice in the context of settings where you maybe have private data that you don't want to share. So, you know, if you just have the default subscription or account with ChatGPT, whatever you feed into there can be used by OpenAI to train subsequent versions of their models. And so if I'm working for a company, I really should not be putting any kind of corporate secrets into that. Or I would want to be very careful about, you know, maybe I write a performance evaluation and I say, ChatGPT, can you make this read better or make it clearer or something like that? I would be very cautious about performing those kinds of tasks with a default account. And so with these personal LLM models, I have a mechanism for safeguarding the privacy of the data that I want to feed into these tools. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity there. I'm not sure if this is answering the question, though. Let me know if I'm misinterpreting.
Mass, if you want to jump in, but we've seen a lot of companies that are starting to build their own internal models. And just because, you know, what you said, they're afraid of their information getting out more publicly.
I mean, in addition, I see, you know, scientific labs, for instance, trying to build these personal LLM models where they say, what I really want to do is I want to use this model for the specific task of doing, say, literature reviews in a specific field, say, you know, advanced manufacturing. And so I want to make sure that I'm going to minimize the chances for it to generate fake references. And I want to, you know, really emphasize quality in the context of advanced manufacturing. I've seen this presented as an aspirational goal and as one of the reasons why somebody might want a personal LLM. But I don't know enough about how successful people have been in this endeavor yet. I think it's something that people are still continuing to work on.
Can you guys hear me? I try to unmute.
Yeah, we got you.
Well, thank you. Yes, because I think there's also what you're talking about, like company-wide models that are behind the firewall and stuff like that. It might be used for that. But so, and I think we're starting to understand that about, you know, protected data and you know, you don't want to share publicly what you're doing in terms of searches and combination of data and technologies. I'm more like looking at the latest trends of where the model are, you know, fast enough that they can sit on each individual user. So now you actually do have a much more of an individual augmentation of the user. So not just company-wide, but user-wide. I'm just wondering what you have seen in that space, whether it is just more about, you know, an advanced version of learning the user's preferences and writing style and automatically be on the lookout of things that is relevant for that person's job and stuff like that. Or is that you see a more the trend than what people are aiming for, not necessarily what is already a reality?
Yeah, I think these are all great points. I'm afraid that I'm just not an expert in that, and I don't think I've got a whole lot of insights beyond what you just mentioned. The only thing I would mention is that these things are very computationally complex. And so in addition to the issues you raised, I have to worry about how much energy and power and battery life it's taking for me to run something like this on my laptop. And more broadly, you know, these things take a huge amount of energy to train. And even at deployment time, it takes a lot of energy to kind of keep answering different queries. And I think there's a lot of interest in trying to understand what are really the essential ingredients in these models. And if we can identify those essential ingredients, can we somehow pare down the size of the models so that we can both train and deploy them much more efficiently? And I think this is really good and important for the environment, also important for being able to deploy them on much more kind of low power devices, such as a cheap laptop. And I think those kinds of things will also kind of help reach those aspirational goals that you mentioned.
That makes sense. We are having conversations with another member about the environmental impact of, of AI and how you need to factor it into your scope 3. So we've started those conversations now too. All right, Mass, did you want to add anything there?
No, I think it's good. I mean, I always try to say, okay, what if it was not computationally like challenged, or if it was not any of these things, just to like have the thought experiment about what we might experience. But I think it's a good answer, and I think there's of course a lot of hurdles in the way, but I think it's still something we already should start looking at this point in time, because I am sure it is coming. We have seen the first local deployment of some size of models at least. So I think it's only going to go forward. So yeah, thank you.
No, thank you. Great question.
All right. Well, Becca, thank you for being in the hot seat. I hope it wasn't too hot, or maybe you needed it to be a bit warm because, you know, it's cold out.
No, but this was really, the questions were great, and it was just such a pleasure talking with you all today.
Yeah, and, you know, if you have any questions about what industry is doing, I'm sure I can connect you with anyone here who would be happy to help. So thank you so much for giving us your time and your expertise and for explaining it in such an accessible way. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. It was my pleasure.
Thanks so much. And thanks, everyone, for coming and sharing your questions.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.